Stay tuned for The Lynn Show. Today's show is all about Steve Binder, and it's only the first half of my interview with Steve. And in fact, when we stopped, there was still so much more that I'm hopeful I will do another interview with Steve and catch up with the rest of his story. Steve's story is remarkable. Not intending to become one of the premier producer directors for film, TV, music, you name it, Steve has done it. He fell in it. It's a remarkable story, which I'm sure that you will enjoy. So hang on. Here come the show.
Hearing from an inner voice, finding choice where there's no choice, with gentle prodding from the voice. Oh, you really can. Deeper, deeper down you dive, where the child's gone to survive.
Is about being who you really are. As I say every week, I believe, as a psychotherapist, and I have all the evidence of my 30 years of private practice to prove it, so many of us are living lives that have nothing to do with who we really are. So many of us had experiences in our childhood, in our family of origin, in our school, on the playground, in our religion, in our culture, something the neighbors said or thought or did, that forced us to decide that something about us wasn't quite right. Something about us was going to bring us a consequence which we did not want. Something that we did or said or thought or some way that we behaved was going to bring a consequence which would embarrass us or make us feel bad or get us neglected or ostracized or teased or even punished. And because we're so flexible, we figured out very young how to pretend that we didn't do that, didn't think that, didn't say that, didn't act in that way. And over time, we got so good at it that we forgot. So many of us are doing what I call living a cover story. That's a version of themselves, but it's not the whole truth about themselves. And also, my experience as a therapist has suggested to me that life is more fulfilling, better, easier, more comfortable when you have access to all that you are. And so the Lynn Show is about making this point, about saying, perhaps you were discouraged in some way from doing, thinking, acting, behaving, believing something that was so natural to you, so much a part of who you really are. And it is valuable to think about that and consider whether you want to and or can recover whatever it was you were forced to hide and deny. So if you want to learn more about that, you can go up on my website, thelynnshow.com, thelynnshow, don't leave the E out of Lynn. Up there, you can get a copy of my book, When You Can, You Will, Why You Can't Always Do What You Want to Do and What to Do About It. And you can ask me any questions that you have. Just click on email me and email me. You can get me to come to speak to your group or organization. Also up on my website are all the shows I've ever done. If you want to listen, all you have to do is click on the little microphone and it will play, and you can download from my website and also from iTunes. The other thing I do in my show is I interview people who make their living or their life with an art, because it is my hope that when you listen to them, you will hear what it sounds like to be who you really are, and you will be inspired to go looking for what you may have left behind. This show is remarkable because Steve Binder is clearly who he was meant to be. He is all of who he is, and yet he found it somewhat by accident. A lot of people that I interview say that, you know, I knew it 2, I knew it 4. I was writing at 6, I was playing the piano at 3, I was tap dancing and entertaining my family by the time I was 7. I knew what it was. Not Steve. Steve had lots of life experience before he serendipitously discovered what would become his life and which would make the difference to so many of us who have been enjoying all of the work that he's done. So Steve tells this better than me, so I'm going to stop talking. Here now is Steve Binder. Okay, so here I am with Steve Binder.
Hi.
Hi. is the way that you think of yourself as a director solely?
First. I realized early on in my career that television is all about the producer. The producer and the owner of the
network. You mean because they have the power?
They have the power. Right. They call the shots. Most producers are frustrated directors, and they hire directors to...
And then they tell them what to do.
Exactly. Movies a little different, or even film and television is different. When you're on a film set, there's a lot more quote-unquote respect coming from upper management and production people, who the director is. For whatever reason, when television started, live got separated out, and it just became, you know, you could really tell most television directors when I began weren't really acclimated, unless they had a stage background, with working with actors.
Mm-hmm.
So they focused on the equipment, and many actors never even saw the director other than heard the voice from the control room on the loudspeakers on the stages.
Wow.
But there was very little communication. And so I felt right from get-go, if I wanted any control over what I directed, I needed to become a hyphenate. And so I joined
Producer-director.
The Producers Guild and became a producer-director. And it was a little difficult in the beginning, after I had built my reputation as a director, to then say, when I was offered a job, that I also want to be the producer. And I was approached early on when Dean Martin went on the air with his series, before Greg Garrison was even involved in his production, and asked by NBC, did I want to produce or direct And I said, I want to produce and direct, and it cost me the job.
Wow. Wow. You know, I want to hear a lot more about that, but I want to tell you the focus that I usually use for these interviews. I told you before, I'm interviewing people who make their life or their living with their art, which clearly you have done. And I am always curious how you got captured by it, how it happened. How does one decide to be a director? When did that happen to you? When and how?
One thing I've learned over the years is that everybody has a unique story of how they became what they became. I don't care what profession they're in. And most people, like myself, stumbled into it.
How did you stumble?
When I grew up in Los Angeles, I had no intention of being in show business. I was not born in the trunk.
Wow.
I didn't even know I had any quote-unquote artistic abilities in that field. My dad had a truck gas station downtown Los Angeles, and I used to go down there and help him when I was going to high school. And I had heard, when I went to college, I registered as a pre-med student at the University of Southern California. And when people say, why did you do that? I said, because I wanted to please my parents, who devoted their life to my sister and I to make sure we got good educations and we had the things that they were denied. And so I wanted to do something,
be it my son, the doctor.
Doctor, lawyer, Indian chief,
right.
Whatever it was, I wanted to be important to them. And the minute we started dissecting frogs, I realized I was never cut out to be a doctor. I can't kill anything. I catch flies and throw them outside while they're still alive. But what happened is when I was in college, just for fun, somebody suggested that I go up to KUSC, which was their radio station, and apply for a job as a student radio announcer. And I did. And I found this kind of dual personality where when I was alone in a control room with a microphone in front of me, I had no inhibitions and I could talk very freely and I was another person. In real life, I won't say I was introverted, but I was very much a loner. I had lots of friends, but on the other hand, I enjoyed my free time by myself. Mm-hmm. And so I found these two Steve Binder personalities. And when USC established what was the beginning of their television, which was going to be educational television in Los Angeles on the campus, I applied as a television announcer. I would never forget that. And didn't get the job because I was so young at the time. But I did well enough to get some freelance work. The university hired me to do training films for the Air Force as a voiceover, etc. And I got smitten. I just really enjoyed it. And because of the Korean War, the draft was still going on. And I had volunteered in my freshman year to join the Air Force cadet program. And I had to sign a 2-year contract that when I graduated, I would be in the Air Force for 2 years. I fantasized being a fighter pilot or whatever. And in my junior year, we were all told that the government had changed its mind and we now had to renew our contracts, but this time for 4 years. When you're that young, 2 years, 4 years, it doesn't mean a whole lot. And thank God my father interceded and said, Steve, do you have any idea
how long
the difference
years
between
is.
4 years and 2 years is? So I chose not to sign the contract. And I was about 3.5 years into my college education. And whammo, I got drafted immediately.
They didn't let you finish?
They didn't let me finish.
Wow.
So I reported to Fort Ord, California. And before I left, a friend of my family was working as a civilian with the Armed Forces Radio and Television Network in Hollywood. And my brother-in-law suggested that I go see him and see if there's any chance of getting into the American Forces Network. So I went to Hollywood and before I reported to Fort Ord, and he gave me an audition as a radio announcer for the Army. And he gave me a nice piece of paper saying I passed the audition and I qualified to be a radio announcer. And I arrived at Fort Ord and I handed it to the whoever he was that was you know, in charge of mustering in new recruits or new soldiers. And he looked at it and he laughed at me and tore it up in front of my face and said, what's this garbage? So I ended up, because I was in pre-med, I ended up in the medical corps for my basic training. First I did 8 weeks of infantry basic training, which everybody had to go through. Mm-hmm. And then they sent me to Fort Sam Houston, Texas, which was in San Antonio, a big medical facility for the Army, and I did an additional 8 weeks of medical training to be a frontline medic.
Oi!
And I came back on a transfer. From there I was going to the shipping point for the Far East, which was Fort Lewis, Washington. And I stopped on the way to Washington. I had 2 days off. Went back to Hollywood, saw the guy that gave me the audition and said, told him my story. And he said, well, it just so happens there's a colonel here that just happens to be in Los Angeles for a week, but he's the commanding officer in Austria. And to me, I wasn't very good in geography either, so I thought Austria could have been Australia as far as I was concerned. But he introduced me to him, and the colonel asked me what my name, rank, and serial number was. I gave it to him, and I saw him scribble it down. And lo and behold, while I was in the medical corps in Fort Lewis, getting ready to ship over to Korea, my commanding officer called me in, and he was very upset. And I said, what's wrong? He said, I have orders here to ship you out to go to Salzburg, Austria. How did you pull that one? And I did. I spent almost 2 years.
You spent the war in Austria?
I spent two years in, well, not completely in Austria, but I was...
But not in Korea.
Not
on the front lines trying to patch up soldiers.
But I was a radio announcer for the American Forces Network in, first the Blue Danube Network in Salzburg, Austria. Then at that time, it was a four-country, a divided country between the Russians, the English, the French, and the Americans. And they all decided to give Austria back to the Austrians. So as a result, I was sent into Germany. And I became a radio announcer in Munich and Nuremberg for the American Forces Network. And to this day, I'm in touch. I belong to an internet organization of all the radio announcers since World War II, which is really fascinating to communicate with them and hear their stories and all this information is being passed on to everybody. Absolutely. There's a television series, and Robin Williams made one called Good Morning Vietnam.
Vietnam, that's right.
So, but it was just a very, very, fortuitous stroke of luck that all this happened. And on top of it all, when I was in Munich, I was kind of adopted by a couple from Hollywood who were working for Radio Free Europe. And the gentleman, Jerry Hausner, who no longer is with us, unfortunately, but he and Jim Backus were the voices of Mr. Magoo cartoons and Gerald McBoing Boing. And Jerry and Velma, his wife, really befriended me. And every time I had any time off, they would cook a home-cooked meal for me at their apartment and so forth in Munich. He told me when I got back to Los Angeles, be sure and look up Jim Backus and a few other friends. And they would help me get into radio. Because by that time, I was a radio announcer.
Yes, right.
I came back to, I got out of the service. First thing I did was get on the phone and call Jerry's contacts. And one of the gentlemen he asked me to call was a gentleman named Pete Burness, who also, unfortunately, is no longer with us. Pete actually died very young. But Pete was the director of the Mr. Magoo cartoons and the... Gerald McBoing Boing, really nice gentleman, and he immediately befriended me because of Jerry and Velma, took me to see the program director of CBS Radio on Sunset Boulevard in Hollywood. And the guy who was the program director, who wasn't very tall, but his desk was so high that I sort of shrunk below it. And he said, is your father Art Linkletter? I'll never forget this. And I said, no, of course not. He said, well, if your father is not Art Linkletter or somebody that important, I wouldn't even bother to try and get in this business, Steve. It's just a tough profession and you'll never get in. And we walked out of his office and Pete Burness was very apologetic, saying, I'm sorry, because he was on the borderline of being rude, you know.
No, I think I don't think that's on the borderline.
Well, you have a strong point. But it also brought out of me a kind of, you know, I'll teach him. And I had one friend in high school who was in my high school club. And he, unlike a lot of my other friends who went on to college and so forth, he decided that he wanted to go straight from high school to get in the entertainment business. So he became an apprentice editor on Star Trek at Paramount. And he was like a celebrity among all of us that were in his high school class. And he suggested to me, while I had just come back and wasn't sure what I wanted to do, I reapplied to go back to college. And he said, you know, Steve, if you get a job at one of the television studios or one of the major film studios, there are a lot of pretty girls running around, and you know, it would be a great summer job for you. Mm-hmm. So I took his advice, and I applied first at CBS Television as a clerk typist. And I took one class, I think, in high school on typing, but I certainly didn't, you know, I wasn't really proficient at it. And the other job I applied for was ABC, which at that time was, you know, I wouldn't even consider them the third network. They were probably, you know, NBC, CBS, 3, 4, 5, and then ABC. You know, there was no Fox. And so, believe it or not, within a week, and I think on the same day, both networks called saying there's a job opening. And I immediately thought, well, if I go to CBS and apply for this clerk typist job to type, you know, scripts and what have you, I'll get fired quickly because they'll realize I can't type. Yeah, on the other hand, ABC seems like, you know, I could go deliver mail and meet a lot of people and see all these pretty girls. And, you know, ABC at that time was so small as a network. I think their only big home run show was the Lawrence Welk Show. And I think Mike Wallace had a show called The Mike Wallace Interview at the time. But that was about it in terms of prestigious primetime television shows. And they didn't have any fences around their building. They had one guard shack as you entered, and they waved you through very easily where, you know the studio thing where the minute the guard realizes you're an outsider, it gets almost impossible to get through the gate. So I took the job in the mailroom. And
this is the old I took the job in the mailroom story? I mean, you know, that I worked my way up to director from the mailroom?
What's a little unusual is that I met the guy who was in charge of the mailroom, and he said, you know, Steve, I only hire guys who don't want to be anything else in life but deliver mail. So if you have any ambitions to be anything in this business, forget it, I'm not going to hire you. So I lied and I said, oh, that's all I want to do is deliver mail, and he hired me. And so I got a chance to go around the lot in Prospect and Talmadge and deliver mail to all the different departments. And one of the ladies who I delivered mail to was the head of the mimeograph department, and I'm sure today nobody even knows what a mimeograph machine is. But it used to be, you know, 3 or 4 pieces of paper with carbon in between them, and you'd roll this big drum, and then it would print whatever was on the initial page. And she said, she asked me what I was, she was a really nice woman. Her husband was actually a floor manager at a department store downtown. And she asked me what I was doing there, and I told her my story in 2 minutes. And she said, you know, if you stay in the mailroom, you'll never get anywhere. She said, why don't you come to my department? I'll make you a mimeograph operator. It's a true story. And I'll try and introduce you to some of the programming people.
Wow.
So I transferred over.
So far, at every stage, there are these people who, for reasons that are not clear, except that you must have been really engaging, want to help you You haven't asked even, but they sort of volunteer.
I find that true to life even today.
Yes, I'm sure that it is. I just wanted to point out that it began. It's there at the beginning.
I'm going to skip some steps, but I was in the mailroom for about 2 weeks. I was in the mimeograph department for less than 2 weeks. And she told me in those 2 weeks I was the best mimeograph operator she ever had. And she introduced me to Seligman and Peter Robinson, who were the station manager and program director of KABC. Selig, in my first meeting with Mr. Seligman, he's sitting behind this humongous desk. I found out, you know, that's part of being an executive. You've got to have a humongous desk on a riser so that everybody who comes in is much smaller than you are. I'm sure it's for psychological reasons.
Sure.
And he said, what would you like to be doing? And I said, I'd like to be sitting in your chair asking you that same question. And he laughed, and within a week, I was offered a job in the control room as an operations director. And those are guys who sit in this dark room with tons of monitors. And my job was to do station break commercials between the programs and to basically put the films or it was before tape even, but the kinescopes, whatever the programs, whatever form they were on, is to put them on the air. And I was there when they launched American Bandstand for the ABC network, etc. And I loved my job. I loved the other operation directors who all kind of were older but befriended me. And then Peter Robinson, the program director, called me and he said, listen, Norman Abbott, who is directing on our staff, is leaving to go to CBS to direct the Jack Benny show and the Bob Crosby show, and we need a summer replacement. Would you be interested? And so I moved into a full-fledged director at KABC. And I'd say this all, the time span was no more than a month and a half or 2 months from the time I decided to go look for girls in show business. And so I went, and one of my first assignments was a pie-throwing comedian named Soupy Sales. And I directed Soupy 5 days a week, and along with Chucko the Clown and Chef Milani's cooking show, and I was given a whole slew of shows to direct. And I realized when I walked in the control room for the first time in my life that it was like a foreign language to me. I didn't know. I didn't understand anything that was going on. You know, usually they have these big no admittance signs on the door. They intimidate an outsider immediately. And when I stuck my head in and I heard all this jargon going on between the director, the technical director, the lighting director, the sound guy, it was, you know, pretty intimidating of how am I going to learn this job. But Norman Abbott, who was the director leaving, was assigned to teach me the job before he left. And in all modesty, I think in a week I knew the job better than he did. It just undeciphered all of
it.
This
was natural for you.
It just fell together, right? And I picked up the lingo really quickly. And I was amused because when I'd be directing, and I think at the time I was, you know, 20 years old, they would, you know, whoever the talent was on the stage, the older guys in the control room would be putting them down because they were young, completely ignoring me. I was completely accepted by the staff, so even though they were much older than I was, sitting there being the director. In fact, the first time I walked on the stage at ABC, some old stagehand came over to me and he said, hey kid, you know, I'm sorry, but you're going to have to leave because there's, you know, only the staff and crew can come on the stage.
Right.
And I didn't say anything to him.
You didn't say I'm the director.
But he found out I was a director about a half hour later. And you know, but we became pretty good friends after that. He joked about it for a couple of, a couple of months after that. But here I was directing, thinking, still not thinking of it as a profession, thinking this is just a
summer job.
I'm having a ball.
Right.
I really enjoy what I'm doing. I like the people I'm working with. And everybody there is being really helpful. In fact, the camera crew, you know, in those days, it was a case of when you start out directing, basically, you have one camera. Then they give you a two-camera show, and then maybe if you're really good, they give you a three-camera show, and that's about it, you know. But I had some really good cameramen who were feeding me advice on lenses and basically, you know, the idea of being able to train myself and educate myself on what cameras and dollies can do and et cetera, technically.
How to use them.
And how to use them and so forth. And I just found everybody incredibly helpful. The only competitiveness were the other quote-unquote young guys who were older than me, but really were, you know, kind of resentful that I got that job. And one in particular who I did befriend after, but it took some time, you know, breaking through the ice because he was the fair-haired guy until I showed up. And now what happened is that Soupy Sales became so popular that it went on the network. Mm-hmm. And I'll never forget this story because, you know, the telephone rang in the lounge and somebody said, "Steve, Frank Sinatra's on the phone. He wants to talk to you." I thought he was joking. I went over and his voice said, it sounded like Sinatra. He said, "You Steve Bender?" "Yes." "You doing the Soupy Sales show?" And I said, "Yes." And he said, "Well, I'd like to come on your show and have a pie thrown at me." And by that time I was convinced it wasn't Frank Sinatra.
Right.
But it was. And it turned out that evidently Soupy, who had two boys, really, because Frank was gone so often from home, that he didn't have a lot of time to spend with Frank Jr. And so Soupy became the surrogate father with his boys of Frank Jr., and this was Frank's way of paying him back as a thank you. And Frank came on the show and was great, and he did the first network show we did with Soupy. The next show was with Mickey Rooney, and the third show I did was with Tony Curtis, who was very popular at the time. And then word came down that the network executive, who was in charge of network directors, realized that a local director was directing a network show without his approval because he evidently was at a golf tournament or something while I got hired and shifted over to that. So it came down from the front office basically that I could continue directing the 5-day-a-week show, but I was being taken off of the late night primetime network show. And I was so naive in those days. I really wasn't sure what the I knew the network guys got a lot more money than the local guys. They got to do the big shows as opposed to the local shows,
right,
et cetera. But my life was never about money. To this day, it's never been about money. So I was just, you know, I saw it as just a great opportunity to be doing something.
Right. You were still having fun.
And totally. Well, I've always had fun.
Yes, right.
But what happened is that I got so infuriated by the injustice of this decision that I decided to, first I wrote a letter to Leonard Goldenson, who I never met, who was evidently at that time the chairman of ABC, the whole corporation, mm-hmm, telling him how I'd been screwed,
right,
how unfair this was. The guy who was assigned to do the network show actually was a friend of mine, Bob Henry, who called me and said, "I don't have a clue how to do this show. Can you teach me?" So I ended up giving him all kinds of learning tools of how to do Soupy Sales, etc. And Soupy, I found, unfortunately, you know, didn't lift a finger to keep me on the network show. And I just felt the whole thing was mishandled. So I left ABC. I resigned. After, you know, nobody apologized and they didn't fire me or anything, but I chose on my own to leave. For every door that closes, a new one opens.
Yeah.
And it couldn't be truer than this case. This changed my life because immediately one of my stage managers, Jimmy Baker, was very friendly with Steve Allen. And Steve Allen was doing a primetime show on ABC at the time that was not very successful, and as a result it got canceled after so many weeks. And Steve had a very bitter taste in his mouth for what had happened, He even mentioned at the time that he may give up being an entertainer and just go into producing, etc. And Jimmy Baker, stage manager, in his spare time was very involved in the Monterey Jazz Festival. And he was involved in a show on ABC Network that Bobby Troup hosted called Stars of Jazz. Mm. And Jimmy really, you know, took to me and what I was doing. And he went to Steve, and with Steve's business manager, who was also a jazz fanatic, and they convinced Steve to put up the money to do 26 half hours called Jazz Scene USA, which would be hosted by Oscar Brown Jr. And 26 of the greatest jazz musicians in the world. And the show had Stan Kenton's big band, Shorty Rogers, Joe Pass, the Jazz Messengers, Nancy Wilson, etc. And we shot two or three shows a day, once a week, until we got to 26 half hours. The show really kind of broke ground because, first of all, it was speculative on Steve's part to put up the money. He was the executive producer of it. And Desi Liu was the distributor, Lucille Ball and Desi Arnaz's company. And to this day, it's shown all over the world. You can find it on YouTube, segments of it, and so forth and so on. But in the middle of all this, Steve called me up and said, I just closed the deal with Westinghouse to do the Steve Allen Show. We're going to do a five-night-a-week syndicated show across from the Hollywood Ranch Market on Vine Street in Hollywood, where Groucho Marx used to do his show of You Bet Your Life. And I'd like you to come over and direct it. And I said, I can't, Steve. I'm doing the jazz show for you, and I'm up to my ears. He said, that's okay. He said, you'll do both of them. And so for about 2 months, I was shuttling between doing the jazz shows and prepping them and then launching the Steve Allen Show. And Steve said, you know, if you get me started, I'll get somebody to replace you if you still feel the same way. And 2 years plus later, I left the Steve Allen Show. But doing the Steve Allen Show, in those days, the late night show was 90 minutes a night, not 60, like Jay or David. And we used to do two shows on Wednesday, one show on Thursday, two shows on Friday. We had only two writers for the entire years that I did the show, Stan Burns and Mike Marmer, who were brilliant in comedy. And Steve obviously wrote a lot of the material. And two things happened. One is that the television critic of LA Times, Cecil Smith, wrote an entire column on me, putting my picture in it and saying, you know, who has the busiest job in Hollywood, and talked about Jazz Scene and Steve Allen. By that time, Steve Allen's show just took off like a rocket. It was incredibly successful. That I attribute to Johnny Carson being under contract to ABC, even after he made his NBC deal to come over and do the Late Show. But ABC prohibited him from leaving his contract early, and as a result, we got like a three-month jump start on NBC and Johnny. Mm-hmm. And so we had the market to ourselves, basically. Right. And in that time, Steve built his audience. And it was like getting, I've described it kind of like I got to go to grammar school all the way to get my PhD in 2 years doing the Steve Allen Show. I met so many people in the business. Steve was...
Sure, everybody was on it.
And gave me a free hand in experimenting. The show was known for its trying new things. I mean, a cameraman came to me one day and said, I developed this telescopic lens in my garage. What do you think of it? And that night I put it on the air, out of focus and everything. But we spent many, many shows with that lens exploring a flea circus, coins, caterpillars. I mean, it was incredible to see these things up close with this lens. But anything went on the Steve Allen Show. And Steve released an article in the New Yorker magazine, an interview that he did, and he said, I have a director who kind of reads my mind and shoots from the hip and seems to know what I'm thinking before, you know, and it, those kind of things really add to getting phone calls for you know, for other jobs, etc. While I was doing Steve Allen, I was approached by three gentlemen who had just made a deal to do an incredible project for the NAACP. And their idea was to do 2 hours, one on the West Coast, one on the East Coast, and close circuit them in Madison Square Garden, in the LA Sports Arena, all over the country in various arenas, and basically what they call four-walling. It was not a television show, it was not a movie, but it was going to be 2 hours of entertainment. People would go to these arenas instead of a basketball game or ice skating or whatever, and they pay money to see this film. Well, I was given the West Coast and total creative freedom. And Bob Banner, another really important you know, icon in the variety business and television before me even, was given the East Coast. And this is the time when Elizabeth Taylor and Richard Burton were the hottest couple in
the world.
The world. And they were on the East Coast cast list, etc., along with Sammy Davis Jr. and all these East Coast people. And I all of a sudden realized that I was given the producer-director reins to this hour. And this is 1962-ish, mm-hmm. I would think. And because the Vietnam War was really, you know, on everybody's tongue, and I was obviously anti-war, period. And I had met Burt Lancaster. And Burt was very much very outspoken when it came to being anti-war and anti the Vietnam War, Cambodia, what have you. So I had volunteered on a couple of other occasions to direct some fundraisers and some you know, events that would speak out against the war. And I called Burt and I told him what I was going to do with the NAACP and would he host the show, narrate it. And he said, no, I'm doing a movie called The Train with John Frankenheimer, and I'm not going to have time to do it, Steve, but I appreciate the offer. And I went to see Nat Cole in Las Vegas, and he turned me down. I had worked on Steve Allen a lot with Tony Bennett, so I went to Tony, who was also happened to be in Las Vegas when I went up there. And I walked in and met with Tony for 2 minutes, and Tony said, you got me. You know, so I had one artist committed to this show on the West Coast, while the East Coast was just loading up with every major star imaginable. And I was getting a little depressed because I'm thinking, how am I going to get all this talent together? And I got a phone call from Bert saying, Steve, I've just postponed shooting a few weeks. The Train thought about what you're doing, and I like it, and I will work with you on it. The minute I had Burt Lancaster on the show, talent started to just fall in. The minute I could drop his name. So we ended up, I'll just roll off the cast list, but we had Edward G. Robinson, Ed Begley, Agnes Moorehead, Bill Cosby's first appearance. We had Cannonball Adderley. We had Gene Kelly. Who else was on there? Barbara McNair. It was incredible, and Nat Cole called me up and got back on the show.
Said I changed my mind.
That's right, exactly. And it was a wonderful, wonderful production. And I had gone to the bookstore and found a little book called I Wonder Why. And the book was very thin, and it was a pictorial book, but with little captions underneath. And I just was glancing at it, and it showed like sand at the beach with some seashells, and the caption would be, I love to feel my feet, the sand beneath my toes, or something. It would be at a zoo, and you know, it would just show a picture of a monkey cage, and it would say, I love to hear the sound of laughter, you know, things like that. You get to the very last page, and it's a little face of a black child saying, "I wonder why some people don't like me." So I got the rights from Shirley Burden, the author. I titled the hour, "I Wonder Why." And our show was from beginning to end, nothing to do with fundraising for the NAACP. It was strictly an entertainment message show, but the message came through the music and the entertainers. And on the East Coast, it became more traditional fundraiser concept, where people made speeches and so forth.
Like the telethons.
And anyway, it turned out to be an incredible experience for me. I had actually, without realizing it, two Academy Award, future Academy Award winners as cinematographers involved in shooting some of these segments with me. And when the show actually aired, it played at the LA Sports Arena here. And I'll never forget it, because I walked in and the place was half empty. And across the street from the sports center was a LA Angels baseball game, and it was packed to the hilt with people. And then eventually, I understood that the local chapters of the NAACP never turned the money into the national chapter, and it was a huge fiasco. But we did it, and to this day, I think I have the only DVD in existence of it. And it was kind of really taught me a lot in terms of, you know, my skill as a director and production, and even as a producer. And it also was the introduction to a gentleman named Bill Sargent, who created, he was one of the three partners who had originally approached me, who approached me again later on when he had his own Theatrovision company and so forth. And when the interesting thing of the project that I did for the NAACP, it's, other than that one day, it's never been seen by anybody. It never played on television. It's never been shown theatrically.
You're kidding.
It just one time.
Who owned it?
Over. Well, initially, I think the three partners who went belly up. And so, I at this point, it's probably in public domain or something. I'm not sure. But not that long after it aired, and it got some great write-ups. It got a really, really nice write-up in the LA Times. It was there when I was, I actually taped the show at CBS in Hollywood. And I did it live, so there was no post-production or editing or anything. And it was, when the evening was over, it was really incredible in terms of the adrenaline and the energy and so forth. And on there, Richard Widmark was one of the talent on it. He came to CBS and saw where we were shooting it. He said, "What are all those seats doing there?" And I said, "That's for the audience." He said, "Audience? I've never done anything in my life in front of an audience." he had a sketch to do, but he did it, as a champion. And he was terrific. But it was pretty historical. Anyway, about a month later, I get a phone call from Bill Sargent. He had started a company that basically never gave up on kinescope, that when videotape appeared, most people forgot the kinescope, which is recording off an electronic picture tube, and that's the way they preserved electronic pictures, images in those days. And but he decided that he was very bright, and evidently when he passed away, they found out he had like 700 patents on electronic ideas, etc. He died, unfortunately, impoverished, but Bill Sargent was, without a question, what later became the prototype to Mel Brooks' movie, The Producers. Bill had these incredible visions and ideas. He was the master at promoting money and to get his films made. He would have everybody from a lumberman in Washington to a stockbroker in Florida to the Mormon church in Utah. I mean, he'd raise money. I don't know how magically people would show up with their checkbooks and sit there writing checks. The problem was that every project he did, he sold 200% of, so he was praying they wouldn't be successful, right. So he'd never have to pay off his investors. Right. And every project he did, and he did a lot of great projects, he lost as far as his own ownership was concerned. The first idea he had was to have Richard Burton, based on his relationship with the NAACP show, he convinced Burton to do Hamlet on his electronovision process. And instead of the normal television electronics screen, technically, you know, we had American standards of you could only have 525 vertical and horizontal lines in a picture, which means when you blew up the picture into a theater, it would look great on close-ups, but the minute you start stretching out these lines, the deterioration was very, you know, visible. So Bill got some electronic engineers together, and they devised a system without any government controls of expanding these lines. So I think when he did Richard Burton doing Hamlet, it was like 700 lines instead of 525. When I did another film for him with James Whitmore, Gibbon Hill Harry, we were up to like 1,200 lines, etc. So the quality was improving. Today we have digital television, and George Lucas is making Star Wars using that technique. So Bill was way, way ahead of his time. But the initial project that Bill came to me with was a rock and roll film called the TAMI Show. And I shot it at the Santa Monica Civic. If you could believe it, and this is 1963, using most of my Steve Allen technical crew, I think I only had 4 cameras to shoot it. But to this day, it is considered for sure in the top 10, if not the top 5, greatest rock and roll films ever made. And basically because, unbeknownst to any of us, and nobody can take credit for this except maybe the musical director, Jack Nitzsche, who suggested the talent for Bill to put into this movie. The cast was, and they were all basically youngsters at the time, was Chuck Berry, Marvin Gaye, Diana Ross and the Supremes, the Rolling Stones, James Brown and the Flames, Leslie Gore, Billy J. Kramer, the Beach Boys, Jan and Dean, all on stage filming at the same time.
You're kidding.
No. I mean, TAMI Show is historical. I mean, it's today, it's still considered one of the great films. The James Brown performance and the Mick Jagger Stones performance are classics. But that led me to say I want to do films instead of television.
So, it's extraordinary, isn't it? And it's only the first hour of the interview. And next week, I'm going to pick this up where I am leaving it off and play you the second hour, which is equally extraordinary. Steve's life just keeps getting more and more extraordinary, and his stories get more and more wonderful. And you'll hear at the end of the next show that I say, well, yeah, well, we'll just have to do this again because we only scratched the surface. So I hope that you will tune in again. I'm sure if you listen to this, you will, because it's really, it's an amazing story. And as you can hear, he's a dear, conscientious, kind. I mean, he's just if there's a good adjective, you can use it for Steve Binder. And as you listen to Steve's story, it is my hope that you hear the way he allowed himself to follow his instincts. Oh yeah, I'll try that. Oh yeah, I can do that. Oh yeah, okay, I'll do that. And how each time that something presented itself to him, he was able to give himself to it, to say yes, essentially. And how that led inevitably to his discovery of what worked for for him, what was necessary for him, where his talents lay, where his inclinations were, what he wanted to do, and of course, who he really is. And I know that listening to this, you can hear it. You hear that this is a man who is himself. He's all of himself. And of course, this is why I interview people like Steve, because I want you to hear it. I want you to ask yourself, is this who I am? Am I saying yes to everything that comes up that looks interesting to me, that feels right to me? And if you're not, then what are the things you have not said yes to? What are the things you might have looked into, explored, and asking yourself, do you know what gets between you and being your real whole self? And of course, as I said in the beginning, if you want to talk about that, you can go up on my website, thelinshow.com. Now, as always, I hope you got something you can use from this show. Be inspired. I always hope that. Maybe it was just reliving some of the history of the entertainment business as Steve relates it, as he lived it. In any case, something that will bring you back, because I will be back next week, same time, same station, and I sure hope you will be too.
You see, I'm getting older, my hair is turning gray, oh, you see my face and figure, I've both seen better days. Well, I won't be retiring, I won't slip out of sight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper, I am going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I just keep returning like some goddamn boomerang. No, I won't go with a whimper, I am going with a bang. See that I have had my shot, my time has come and gone. Oh, won't I please get off the stage, let someone else get on. Well, I won't be relegated or leave without a fight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper, I am going with a bang. Life's a bell I keep on ringing, not a chime that I once rang. You may think it's unseemly, well, I don't give a dang. No, I won't go with a whimper, I am going with a bang. Rising from the ashes, every chance I get. I may be running out of time, but it ain't over yet. 'Cause me and Sister Phoenix, we won't give up the flight. No, no, we will not go gentle into that good night. And I won't go with a whimper, I'm going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I may not be as juicy, hell, but I still got some tang.